Excellent. Welcome to Taking Responsibility for Torah, the podcast. I'm here with Rabbi Moshe Kurtz, who is the author of Challenging Assumptions. I assume that means that he means to challenge other assumptions, although it could be he makes assumptions that challenge others. Either of those is welcome. Rabbi Kurtz is a graduate of Yeshiva Darkei Torah at Yeshiva Sha'alvim. He holds a BA in psychology from Yeshiva College, an MS from Azrieli, and Smicha from Reitz, and he was a close Talmud of Rav Moshe Tendler's Zichrono Livracha. He's previously served at Young Israel of Plainview and is currently assistant rabbi at Agudat Shalom in Stamford, Connecticut. And I look forward very much to this conversation, which will focus on a chapter of the book which deals with issues of political correctness and halacha. And I think it's an interesting sample of the idea of bringing challenging, I hope both cultural and assumptions in the broader world and in the Torah world about what is the best form of behavior and policy. I think it's really terrific and important for someone to be willing to bring a halachic lens to these issues and has to say courageous as well. And I look forward very much. Look forward very much to the conversation. Okay, so I should say I met Rabbi Kurtz first a while back in a framework that was a co-responder of the Rabbi Kurtz, a framework that showcased both integrity and courage. So I'm really looking forward to the conversation. So why don't we start by having you tell us why what you want people to get out of the Sefer as a whole, and you can give purchase information if you want as well, and then talk about how you frame the issue Bichlal in this particular chapter, which I think is called a harmful speech. Right, though I think I was correct in bringing that it's about that it's supposed to approach issues of political correctness. And then we'll try and bring that around to one harmful speech sensitivity and political correctness, with a subtitle about Anas Dvarim, and we'll talk about Anas Dvarim and whether that's to what extent and what and how that's the right framework. Then bring it around, I think, to you wanted to teach a Rav Moshe, which I excerpted on the right on the sheet I sent you. So I think the excerpting, unless you disagree with it, is a fine way to approach it. And then I guess what I'll try and do is challenge some conclusions. And
And
we'll
I
see
want
what
to,
happens.
so Rabbi Klapper, I want to really thank you for the opportunity to learn together. We're both New Englanders. We're just on the opposite side, but I still feel like we're neighbors. So it's good to be able to speak on Zoom, but hopefully, God willing, Bikarov in person, one way or the other. So you asked about the title. The title was made up by the publishers. I, of course, gave my haskama. I approved of it, but I was sitting with them bouncing ideas off the wall, and they were trying to determine what the common theme of the book was. So the common theme really is each and every chapter, which were originally disparate essays, whether it be in the RJJ, like the one we're going to look at now, or the Lehrhaus, or Torah Musings, or different forums, each and every one of them was challenging assumptions of a different group of people. So we're going to look at questions of political correctness. There was one on Lo Yilvash on cross-dressing, which I think we initially corresponded about. Those definitely are challenging assumptions that are held perhaps in the more liberal world about sensitivity of speech, about gender norms. But there's also essays in there about challenging, let's say, in the Zionistic world or the more conservative world, such as the notion of having national flags in shul. Maybe I am a patriot, but should I be singing songs about the state of Israel in shul? Should I have the Israeli flag hanging right next to the Aron Kodesh, which has the Torah, which symbolizes God? And then there's also assumptions in there just in the mainstream, or I should be careful with mainstream, but the typical Orthodox community, things like making a siyum during the 9 days so everyone can have a Fleischfest and everyone can eat their meat. Questions of repetition and tircha d'tzibura, having a chazan schlep out the davening, or a rabbi schlep out the davening with the sermon and imposing on people's time. And then I would say also there was one essay in there which was meant specifically to challenge my own assumption, which was about bringing children to shul, because for my first year, for our first year after having our daughter, my wife had a 40-minute commute early in the morning, so I was basically bringing my daughter, who was less than a year old, to Shacharis every single day. And I began asking myself the question, am I doing the right thing by persevering and bringing her to shul? It's going to make a bit of a disturbance for those who are there, even though the people there were really nice. They're like, oh, it's so cute to have her. But in the end of the day, I mean, she's also a distraction. You know, even if they think she's adorable, they're thinking about her, not thinking about God. So I kind of delved into that topic to hopefully not just substantiate what I walked in with already. Something that I think I listened to your podcast at the beginning of your previous summer session, you were talking about how, you know, you shouldn't just come in with your preconceived notion and marshal a bunch of Torah sources to substantiate your preconceived viewpoint. So I would lie if I was saying that there was no bias in what I was writing. All humans have bias involved. I tried to be descriptive 95%. And then 5%, I tried to give a little bit of my own chiddush and analysis, but that's what I attempted. You may argue that, like, you know, that Ruba Kakula, the majority of the material, was Moshe Kurtz's bias, and then there were some Makoros to back him up in the end of the day. So that's basically what kind of led to the book. And I would just say, you know, sometimes people, and I hope I'm not becoming that kind of person, you know, you put out a book and all of a sudden you think you're like an Adam Chashiv, you're the most special person. Look, you know, in a day and age of Otzar HaChachma, Masifta Gemaras, anyone could put together what I did just with basic yeshiva education and basic technological background. What the only chiddush I think I'm really providing is that questions like what we're going to talk about, political correctness, I just was doing my Google searches. I went to all the usual sources. I went to the Laras, I went to the Torah musings. I tried to look through tradition, and I didn't see anyone who simply connected the dots of the question of Onas Dvarim and the notion of politically correct speech and sensitivity. So all I did was try to make a first attempt at trying to map out that sugya, but certainly it was with the hope that Gedolim v'Tovim imeni, those who know more than me, such as yourself, would then see that and be able to hopefully, l'ravcha shmeisa, to be able to expand the conversation about it.
Okay, sir, you get major points listening to the podcast. The compliments were not necessary, but listening to the podcast, absolutely, absolutely essential. And I hope we'll get to talk about some of the other topics as well, you know, after this goes viral. okay, so let's talk about this particular chapter, right? So let me see it, right? As I understand it, so the first move, I should say, the warning is that people who aren't aware they're mechadesh, or the biggest mechadesh, so we'll have to see, right? Whether your self-description, right? Whether your self-description is accurate. I think I got it from somebody else. That's like how the Dafka, how that it's people like the Nesiv and the Chazanish get to be major mechadesh without any sense of fear because they think they're just saying Pashup Shah. yeah, when you're aware of being mechadesh, then you have to have a certain degree of caution. So that is that the first claim is that political correctness, the proper frame for the question of whether we have a strong bias towards the feeling of the person who is in some way harmed by language, right? Whether the bias is you have to avoid the harm, or whether whether there is a strong sense that that you have to feel justified harm.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think that's the way. Right now, we'll talk at the end. I think about whether anas varm relates to all kinds of harm or only some kinds of harm, and whether let's work on that assumption for now. Right, we won't challenge that assumption yet. But anas varm is the right framework. So then, right. So you set up, I think, at least two frameworks for talking about why there might not be a bias in terms of what we call, I guess, prior restraints in American law, right? Things that you're not, right? Things that you shouldn't be allowed to say even before somebody objects to them. And certainly after somebody says this will be objectionable. So one was a framework in terms of who the objects of your speech are. There are certain people who don't deserve the same kind of protection as others. Mm-hmm. Right. So I want to try and bracket that for now. I think that's a big topic. We can talk about that. And I think we also have to mention that that there are people on the other side of it, right, which is an halakha, there are people who deserve particular protection, right, the ger, for example, and things like that. And the question of whether those categories can be generalized also, right, matter whether they're interpreted narrowly or whether they reflect a particular kind of status in society for which there is more protection for Nazdvarim than others. And there's a second argument, which I think would bring us correctly to the Rav Moshe, which is that there's a circumstance where we see people as responsible for their own, right? They're bringing the harm upon themselves, as opposed to your, right, as opposed to your harm. And the analogy, one of the analogies brought is that there are certain kind of cases in commerce where we say, right? You didn't deceive the person, they brought the deception upon themselves. And so the question is whether there's a parallel notion that you didn't harm them, they brought the harm upon themselves as a result of your verbal speech. So that, tell me, add to that picture as you will.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I mean, one, just the last point that you brought up about people self-deceiving themselves, as the case in the Gemara that you're referring to. So there's, I didn't really relate it together, but as we're talking, there's another chapter in the book, which I wanted to address the question of censorship in Jewish education. So in that whole entire topic of Ketzer Merakdif Nei Akala, the Bishan Beis Hillel, and all the literature surrounding that, part of the discussion is, you know, when you say the Kala is na v'chasuda, so are you complimenting her physical attributes or are you complimenting her midos? And because it's open to interpretation, that's not considered a form of lying, people can self-deceive themselves into what you're actually saying. So there is a little bit of a motivation behind both of those chapters. The point that I'm trying to, you know, get across is kind of a almost a classic liberalism, the importance of being able to exchange ideas. So that was just one side point I wanted to make, that those sugyas, I think, are related. But you did say we'd bracket it off, so I think I'll speak to it briefly. And if you want to come back to it, we can do that, which is the discussion of who is deserving of these protections of Onas Devarim. As you said very well, of course, the prototypical case in the Mishnah about Metzia, it talks about a ger. It talks about certain disadvantaged populations who are very likely to be taken advantage of. And those people we need to be especially careful to. So that's not a chiddush. What's interesting, and I originally was not going to put this in the essay, but when I was speaking with my mentor, Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schachter, he actually encouraged me and said, this is a important component of the sugya to put into the essay. So it's a little parenthetical, but I think oftentimes when Onas Devarim gets, I don't want to be alarmist, but for lack of a better term, work with me, it could get weaponized to censor ideas in the Torah. So for instance, I'm not necessarily going to use the phraseology or the term Onas Devarim, but I'll say I am offended by you expressing this idea or this halacha in the Torah, and therefore I think we should cut this conversation short. So the question is, sometimes that argument is made from a place of in principle thinking that a halacha in the Torah is immoral, is incorrect. So the point I wanted to make wasn't that, we see that there are people who in principle disregard the Torah, so therefore we should have a field day and do Onas Devarim to them. I believe even the Chafetz Chaim, which I think you want to talk about, the Chafetz Chaim, talks about how even if Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, there's no issue of causing Onas Devarim, there's still one's own midos, Bein Adam L'Atzmo, that even if you're allowed to, you know, even if there's no Isser of Lashon Hara toward a non-Jew, it doesn't mean it's the ethical thing to speak Lashon Hara about a non-Jew. But the important reason I brought that up is just that people who are in principle saying you can't have certain halachic discussions because I'm offended by it, their argument, at least from an Onas Devarim standpoint, may have no water, might not hold water because they are in principle rejecting a halacha. So they're basically using Onas Devarim to cancel other mitzvos in the Torah, which of course does not compute.
Okay, so I did want to bracket that, so I'm going to, you know, but I think it comes up in the context of reflection. I don't disagree with the outcome that there has to be free, generally, I think, there should be a very, very strong default, I would say, towards being allowed to express any Torah idea. I think that the question of whether Onas Devarim is the right framework, I think, is open to question. So let's, the other way, like whether there should ever be an issue of Onas Devarim. But I want to address that in the context of the Rav Moshe. So why don't we go to the, I'm going to share my screen now. Let's go to the Rav Moshe and let's see how we, and let's see how we read that Rav Moshe. And then, right, and which I think Rav Moshe makes the argument, right? The argument that you brought him in for is the argument about self-causing. But I think it's possible the conversation about that will raise the other issue, right? The question of how Rav Moshe's analogy, how Rav Moshe is analogous to the question we're addressing may raise that issue about what the proper scope of Onas Dvarim is. Okay, so we're in Igros Moshe, Ebenezer Chelik Bet Simon Aleph. Do you want to just read it? Do you want to introduce it outside and then read selections? What's your preference?
Well, I think, you know, there's definitely a line, I think, later on that I specifically want to emphasize, but, you know, I can summarize the basic idea behind the tshuva.
Okay, so why don't you summarize the basic idea, then maybe I'll suggest particular lines and see where it will be
okay. Okay, certainly. And there's, if you don't get to it, there's a specific line I was thinking of as well. I mean, essentially, this tshuva in Igros Moshe, which I found by way of a very handy sefer, aptly named Kuntres Onas Dvarim, compliments to Otzer HaChachma for having anything on there. And in this Kuntres Onas Dvarim, I was looking, I'm like, someone has to address this question, because what was the question I set out to address? The question I set out to address is, what happens when Reuven says something and they don't mean to be malicious? They're just expressing an idea. It could be a political opinion. It could be a Torah opinion. It could be even a joke. And they don't mean to cause Shimon harm. But Shimon is adamant and says, no, I am emotionally harmed and distressed by what you said. Whose responsibility is it? Who's it incumbent upon to be accommodating? Can Reuven just say, I'm sorry that it offends you, but it shouldn't curtail my right to speech? So I was looking for that, to solve that question. And I finally came by a section in the Kuntres Onas Dvarim in which he makes reference to this tshuva of Rav Moshe. Now, this tshuva of Rav Moshe initially doesn't sound like it's talking about our topic, as that's how it works in general. The tshuva is talking about, you have two brothers. They're in the they're in Shidduchim. They're looking to get married. And the younger one, as the stories always go, the younger one manages to find a suitable mate first, while the older one is having a bit of a tougher time finding his dream woman to marry. So the question is asked to Rav Moshe Feinstein, should the younger one, out of deference to the dignity of the older one, delay his wedding? Now, this question, of course, is not new. This goes back to biblical cases, which are expanded in the Talmud, which he references in the Tshuva. Of course, going back to Leah and Rachel, and also the Benos Slavchad that are dealt with in the Gemara. The Benos Slavchad also, the Gemara talks about them being mentioned in order of their name, and that it's proper to marry them off in that order. Now, the question is, this is a side point in the sugya, whose responsibility is it? Is it the father's responsibility to marry them off in age order, or is it the children's responsibility to ensure amongst themselves that they get married off in age order? But Sir Moshe first makes an argument, and he says that, first of all, you have a mitzvah midoraisa perivarivya. There's a biblical obligation, be fruitful, multiply, open up the sefer chinuch, the first mitzvah right over there. So how is it possible that you can delay this mitzvah when you've already found a proper shidduch? You know, it's like mitzvah bal yelcha al tachmid sena. I don't think he used that phraseology, but that's basically what he means. That's his first argument from within the parameters of the mitzvah pruvu. So that's interesting, very relevant to the sugya of marriage. But for our purposes, there's a particular line which I think is perhaps later. Was that a little bit later? Okay. I brought my copy of Igros Moshe to read it from there, because I underlined everything in there beforehand. So we are all the way at the beginning of Evan Ezra, I do believe, right?
Yeah.
Chelik Beit. Chelik Beit, right?
Yeah.
Half million. Or Chayim. And Evan Ezra should be in here toward the end. Okay. So Rav Moshe Feinstein makes the argument. Maybe you'll highlight it on the page when you find it. I'm just used to the Tzura Sadaf. Maybe is that it? So he says, so maybe because there's halvanas panim, there's humiliation. Now, we can talk about whether it is right, you know, whether it's the right mindset for the older brother to be humiliated, the younger brother got married first, but that I'm not in the business of doing that. That's just the reality. He feels humiliated by it. That's the community he grew up in. Okay, we'll take the facts as they are. So maybe the younger brother should be machmir for not humiliating and not causing an affront to the dignity of his older brother. This is the critical line from Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe says that who's causing the bush over here? Who's causing the humiliation? It's not the younger brother getting married and then causing humiliation to the older brother. Rather, the younger brother is doing something that's considered a neutral action. He's going about his life normally. And then, what do you know? I wouldn't even call it a result. As there's a neutral, normal situation, and then his brother interprets this situation as something that is busha, that's humiliating for himself. But the younger brother is not the origin of the busha. The older brother, who's interpreting it as something humiliating, that otherwise is neutral, or maybe even shav simcha for the younger brother. So that is something that he's doing on his end.
Okay. So let me, right. So I agree. That was the line I had. I agree. You know, that was the core line you had. So let's talk about what it.
Oh, if I may, there was one other line I want to emphasize, if I may. Just a few lines down from there, he says, and this is also important, you know, because you think about it, take like, you know, of course, marriage is rightfully so a very sensitive topic, but we'll take some maybe just slightly less sensitive. Imagine you have a kid who gets into the Ivy League college or gets into the yeshiva high school, and you want to celebrate the fact, you want to make a post on Facebook, my son or my daughter got accepted to X gap year program or got into X college. So the question is it permissible to share something like that publicly when someone whose kid did not get accepted is going to see that and is going to feel downtrodden or humiliated by it? Think about even just something as minor as, I see this all the time, it's Yuntiv season right now. So someone will post on Facebook, they'll post a picture of their refrigerator and freezer that's full of delicious, expensive meats and foods, and they show a whole table that's beautifully set. On the one hand, wow, they're promoting Kavod Yuntiv. They're promoting Oneg Shabbos. They're promoting this idea that we should take our religion seriously. But on the other hand, what about the person who can't afford to have all those settings? What about the person who doesn't have the ability to have all those people around their table? What does that say to them? So on the one hand, my heart aches for people like that. But on the other hand, I think Rav Moshe makes a certain point that on the one hand, we shouldn't be flaunting what we have. We shouldn't be, I think I may put in a footnote, it's like loeg larush. We shouldn't be sticking it in people's faces that we have something that they don't have. But he also says, but on the other hand, one should not be hindered from living their life and from getting certain accomplishments because someone else might feel bad that they don't have it. So I think Rav Moshe is drawing a line between being able to live your life while also not flaunting it at someone else's face.
Excellent. So those are right. Those are both the lines I had pulled.
Oh, out. Okay.
Exactly. Right. The last part I think is really important. I usually frame this as a really important halakhic principle generally, which I get the formulations from Lichtenstein, that people have a right to live a normal life, and halakha presumes the right to live a normal life. Lichtenstein used this in the context of why you get to keep oxen, even though oxen keep causing damage. Why don't we ban oxen the same way we ban dogs, right? You're a dangerous dog, right? Right. The answer is, right, you have a right to oxen. And I use this in the context of why we don't require IVs on Yom Kippur. Right. And I think and then I use it, you know, more controversially as to why we shouldn't require hormone therapy to avoid orthodox infertility. And in general, people have a right to live a normal life, and halacha doesn't impose excessive burdens as a presumption. So let's take that as a given, right? I think that you're exactly right. I want to tell the first line you have in your motion, I think, that was more relevant to your immediate thesis.
Yes.
The other one is not an auditorium thesis, it's a broad thesis. And I think, you know, it relates, you know, it allows for a much broader conversation. I mentioned the email of Dr. Benny Brown about the way in which he critiques what he called the Chofetz Chaim's halachicization of what the speech ethics.
Yes.
And right, and you know, because the risk, you know, at the end of all the satire, you know, that about the, not everyone gets it as satire, but the, you know, the ones where the Chofetz Chaim ends up being happy talking to farmers for hours because they talk about manure, and talking about manure is really the only thing left to from Jews, right? Right. So what constitutes normal conversational life is a big deal. And Anas Dvarim is just the chelik of the general issue about the extent to which halachic speech ethics are supposed to prevent people from engaging in normal conversation. We do have an interest in people finding out about each other's things, even though almost anything you find out about somebody else will be in some sense harmful, such that you could make a claim of the Isra Lashon Hara. But I think the thing that you get out of this Rav Moshe, which I think, right, is that Rav Moshe says that the older brother does not have a right to be embarrassed. Right, that's the, and therefore you're not responsible.
I would maybe just adjust that slightly, if I may. I mean, there's nothing, I mean, I think he does come off a little bit critical of the brother feeling that way, but if I may adjust Ramosha slightly, even though that's not what he's saying, I would go so far as to say the brother is welcome to feel the way he does, but it doesn't impede the younger brother from going about his normal life still.
So I think that's the second line. I want to focus on the first line we talked about, right?
Okay.
Right. Hine gamli nina boshet urakshe batzmo mitbayesh mizeh. Right. So I think, so here's how I understood it. Now tell me, right? Tell me where you're. So it's a really interesting line, right? It's not, religious says, it's, right, in terms of the embarrassment, it's just that he is embarrassed by this. Mm-hmm. Right. That's a literal translation. Mm-hmm. And then he explains, he says, because look, the fact of not being married at this age is not itself an embarrassing thing, because there are all sorts of really good reasons not to be married.
Right.
You could, right, you could think you won't be able to learn. You could think you don't have enough money yet. And so it doesn't cause other people to think less of you. It shouldn't intrinsically make you think less of yourself.
Mm.
It's just, right, the brother must be embarrassed by not being married, but if he were embarrassed by not being married, so then he should get married. Which raises an interesting question, like what happens if the brother in fact is not married for a reason that is legitimately embarrassing? Right, I think that's, you know, and it's solvable, right? And then I think you have to thought the second reason. But I think that's an interesting question about the extent to which Rav Moshe thinks the issue of bullshit, which I would note he doesn't frame necessarily as a Nas Dvarim, right? I don't think he says that explicitly. He talks about bullshit.
He doesn't, as far as I didn't see that word come up in the tshuva at all, which I think that's a fair point. He doesn't use Onas Dvarim, but I think, you know, like Rav Elchanan Wasserman makes the point, a lot of these mitzvot being adam lechavera, when it comes to kavana, they do share similar parameters.
Yeah, I think they're, you know, I think, well, okay, we can talk about, I love that Rav Elchanan, so we'll talk about another one. We can talk about the great, that's it, I should, you know, advertise this in Responsibility Inscribed, the journal that my center put out on Hilchos Lashon Hara and journalism some years ago. So that, right, so that's a big, I make a big deal about Rav Elchanan, who generalizes his Rebbe, the Chofetz Chaim's claim, right? It's basically a generalization of what the Chofetz Chaim says about Lashon Hara. Rav Elchanan says that's true of all mitzvot adam lechavero, and it's a really interesting, right? They're all mutual to'elet under certain circumstances. Right. But here Rav Moshe says that there's no bullshit, there's no actionable bullshit, there's no bullshit that generates restraint, because the embarrassment is self-generated. Now the question is, what generates this, right? Why is he embarrassed by this? So there are two ways, right? One is, if he's embarrassed by this, well, he has a good reason, in which case he shouldn't be embarrassed, or he has a bad reason, in which case he should be embarrassed. Right, that, I think that's the so the question is whether that plays out in the same way with somebody. Right. Whatever. If there's a social situation where lots of people, in fact, will treat you as less regarding this, right? This is an issue that I think, you know, you've addressed. Many people have addressed the status of singles. That's what we're talking about here, right? The status of singles in the Orthodox community. So what happens if the impact of this is that every, right, is that in fact this will hold up to public and hold up to be a public display the fact that you're not married in a situation where everyone in the society illegitimately, right? There's nothing you could do about it. Mm-hmm. Right? It holds up your failure to find an adequate marriage partner, right? Because you're not considered adequately marriageable in the community for whatever, right? For whatever reason. So do you think Rav Moshe would take the argument in that case also where the person has a legitimate fear of a decline in social standing? Right. Would that, what do you think his argument applies?
Right. So I think that's a really good diuk, which I think I wasn't as sensitive to initially, which is why I'm glad that we're learning together right now, which is that Rav Moshe, he doesn't just simply stop where I stopped. I guess you can tell from where I stopped in the quote, right? He didn't just say Rak Sheba Atzma Mispayish, means that he is causing the busha to himself. He continues to Harbe Yisha Shem Sachrim Milisa Bishvil Harbe Tamim. There are people who don't get married for many reasons. For learning, for other reasons. So what you're saying is, I kind of read it as Rav Moshe was just throwing in reasons why a person wouldn't be embarrassed. But you're saying that's part of the halachic argument, that because his busha is not justifiable, therefore the busha would not apply. But this is interesting. Let's say this is someone who's been trying to get married for a long time, and they go on date after date after date, and they're very open, they're trying, it's not working for whatever the reason might be. Would Rav Moshe's argument to stop a younger to not stop a younger brother from getting married apply here? You would still have the Piri of Arivia argument,
right?
Granted, that's probably what Rav Moshe would say anyway, I would imagine,
and the normal life argument,
right? And the normal life argument, but putting this in a vacuum, yeah, from a busha standpoint, maybe, right. So there could be justified busha. You call someone, I think one of the Makoris put up there by a derisive nickname. So that's justified to have busha when someone calls you by a nickname that is not complimentary to you. So I think I don't have an immediate answer to it. I guess I would wonder, other than a Rav Moshe scenario where we might see this. Certainly, it behooves people like myself, and I hope I've been doing this until now. If not, I do apologize that in my speech, when we talk about singlehood, Baruch Hashem, I'm married and hope to remain married, God willing. That's how it should be. But, you know, it's when I get up to give a sermon, many times in sermon topics, we, you know, if you want to keep things nice and fluffy, you just talk about the importance of family and the importance of passing on the legacy to the next generation, talk about shalom and support the same, you know, like all like the typical go-to topics. So one of those go-to topics, talking about like legacy and family. But what about those who, you know, aren't married? What about those who don't have children? And it's something that I struggle with a lot. I was at a session with Rabbi J.D. Schachter recently, Arche Kala, and he drove this point home. He said, you know, you can't just assume that everyone in your audience has kids when you talk about the importance of kids. And it's like a very fraught topic. When I wrote that children in shul essay that I gave this year at shul, and I talk about the beauty of having children in shul, at the same time, I was like, I don't want to, you know, be loig the rush. I don't want to push it in anyone's face who might be struggling to have children.
I think that's right. We could talk about, you know, not just about singlehood, right? The questions are, what are the things about which people are legitimately embarrassed intrinsically? What are the things in which people are right to be afraid of social embarrassment, even if they are, perhaps they ought not to be embarrassed? And what are the things about which, you know, there's just no right, right? You know, it's your fault. It's your fault if you do it. And then within that context, what are the things that even if some people, right, maybe we have a social interest in promoting marriage, such to the point that social interest is worth, right? And children, right? And figure out how we balance that against the right of people. Okay, because we're going to run short of time, I want to make one other point. I don't want to read the chorus together. The other question I want to ask is, and that relates to Rav Moshe. So in the example you give, and you said a number of people feel that they're offended by what you say, people feel they're harmed by what you say. And Rav Moshe talks here about, and I think that you're right, actually, that's what Anaz Devarim often talks about, is about humiliation. And I'm wondering whether Anaz Devarim is, Bichlal, the right framework to talk about, like, Do I think that it's onas dvarim? Is it onas dvarim if I intimidate you in some way about something? Is that what the issur is? If I offend you, right? Let's put, I say something that you find really, really offensive. I'm not sure that's onas dvarim per se. So you feel offended, right? If you feel offended but not humiliated, is that right? Do you think that's onas dvarim?
Right. So the working definition of onas dvarim I've been using is to cause emotional distress. In fact, the word dvarim is lav dafka. Already in the literature, you see that, if you do it in sign language, you don't do it with literal words, but you basically are I think it's eliciting a certain response. Now there is, I put in a footnote because it's a whole different framework. And I thought it was, I took a look at it, but I didn't want to work off that definition. Rabbi Bleich, he had an article in which basically he argued that what's onas dvarim? Onas dvarim is when you cause the other party to feel less than. You do something to make them feel inferior to you. I believe that was his definition, more or less. So So that actually, if it's very nicely with this, unfortunately very nicely with this tshuva from Rav Moshe, because it's literally what's happening with this brother here. He's made to feel less than his younger brother because he did not have the same life achievement as of yet. So that was, but otherwise my working definition was to elicit some form of emotional distress.
That's any form of emotional distress.
Any form of an emotional distress. Now, the examples in the Gemara, which I think you put on the source sheet, I think somewhere here talks about a kinoi, about giving a like a derisive.
Yeah, so we'll get there. Don't worry about it. I'm not sure. I think it's worth thinking about whether there are certain kinds of emotional distress that halacha just says per se, right? That's not your
role. Just to go back to Rav Elchanan, which he mentions about Toelis, I believe it's there. He gives the example of, let's say, a teacher who's teaching a Yasum, an orphan. On the one hand, the Mishnah tells us that we do need to be extra sensitive to them. Right. But on the other hand, he still needs to, he might have to cause some distress to him by disciplining him to some basic extent. So that's, putting that one in there as well.
Yes, so I think that there are conflicts of values, right? That's part of the normal life thing, right? Is embarrassment a legitimate tactic of pedagogy, right? So I often point out that Torah Brios is docho old rabbanans, but there are times when the rabbanan punishment for something is humiliation, right? That we do things dafka to the levayish, so there has to be places where it's mutter. I just wonder whether certain things like I find your position offensive because I disagree with it so deeply. I find it deeply, deeply immoral. Is it onas dvarim for you to take your political position? I don't know. I don't know that I have a right to feel emotional distress because of your politics.
Well, that is my argument. In the end of the day, I mean, that's basically. I mean, if I had to summarize everything, I'd say, if I know that saying something is going to cause you emotional distress, even if I don't intend it, I shouldn't do it. But in an instance where I'm not the origin of your distress, you're taking my political opinion, and because you don't like it, you are. And this is a point I wanted to make as well, if I may do so, hopefully briefly. Which is, I don't think people are consciously saying to themselves, I saw that opinion on Facebook, and now I'm going to rile myself up so that I can, shower him with my righteous indignation and get on my high horse and assume the moral high ground. I think it's a subconscious process that's popular in our culture now. It's just the zeitgeist of what we live in, that people like assuming the moral high ground. So I think many people, I don't even know if they are genuinely offended, but there's like this twisted gratification of feeling this visceral reaction because it makes you feel like a better person when the other person is morally inferior. It thereby makes you the superior one. So
right. I agree with that. The nuance I'm trying to put in, right, which I don't think we'll have time to develop fully because I wanted to make the halachic claim, is that, but there are things in the world of political correctness where people are legitimate, right? People are not wrong to see that kind of, they're not necessarily wrong, let's say, to say, that particular position does actually cause me social and media humiliation. People treat me as less. Mm-hmm. If you say that about me, it diminishes my social standing when you refer to us that way.
Right.
So I want to leave right now. So I want to talk about, right, whether bring it on your. I want to talk about the argument that there's a halachic category called you brought it upon yourself. Right, as opposed to the Ramosha. So let's go through that, Larry, and then we can resume at some other point. And then I want to leave it that question, like, within the realm of political correctness, we haven't talked about specific examples. All right, what are the cases about which you don't even need to get to that kind of argument because we think there's no legitimate basis for action at all? What are the things where we say you're burning on yourself in the sense that there's no reasonable basis for the way you feel? And then the question is there Hetzer? Well, well, there is a reasonable basis, but you don't have to feel that way. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's take a look. So let's take it right. So we're coming from a Gemara, right? And if you're following on screen with me now, right? So go to the Gemara talks about nicknames, and the key line that matters, I think in your argument was the Gemara says, well, what's the difference between calling somebody a shame ra, giving them a bad nickname, and humiliating them in public? Isn't that the same thing? If you call somebody smelly or stinky, right? You call them stinky, right? And as Gemara says, Avol gav the dush bebishmei, right? Even though the person has been known as stinky since they were 5 years old, right? You still can't call them, right? It's common. You still can't call them stinky. Okay, right. I think that's a stinky being an extreme case, right? Or perhaps. Okay, then Rashi says on that the dush be, because he's used to it. For Hurgol Bekap from Machanimoto, okay, he's already used to being called that. Vein Panav Mitlabno says his face doesn't turn white, so it really shouldn't be Halbanapanim. Umikomakom Zel Hachlimo Mitkave. But nonetheless, this person intends to humiliate them. Okay, so the argument I understood you to be making was Rashi saying that therefore the whole Isur is defined by Kavana.
Yeah, so. I think it's very, not just from here, but from other sources, kavana seems to be critical. But the question is, what do we mean when we say kavana? Does kavana mean intent to cause, to elicit a response, or awareness of a certain response?
Right. Okay. So I think the outcome you came with, there's some people who say it's dafka intent, right? That's where we get through Gustman, right? The argument from Gustman. And awareness has limits, right? To what extent do you have a responsibility to be aware?
Mm-hmm.
Right, but let's take a look. Let's take the term undifferentiated. I want to argue, for starters, right, that the Rashi doesn't prove it one way or the other. All the Rashi shows is that there are circumstances where kavana is sufficient. Mm-hmm. Right there, right. It's perfectly right. Rashi says in this case, even though there's no objective harm, right, you still did something wrong because you intended to cause him harm. That doesn't tell me that there's no issur if I did, right, even if I didn't intend to cause harm, if I do.
Mm-hmm. So right, so you're reading of Zel Achima Mischaven is, it sounds like he's still intending to cause some sort of negative response.
Right, even though there isn't one. But of course, if there was one, who would care whether he intended or not?
Well, that's interesting because maybe I have a slightly different reader of Rashi. I don't think he's humiliated to the extent that it's Halvanus Panim. He doesn't turn white,
right?
But it still causes some degree of distress every time he hears that.
Maybe. So maybe, right? So maybe that's, maybe right? You could say that maybe Rashi thinks that even with some degree, you still need to come, right? You still need to come out. Okay, right. So let's put those as two possibilities, right? We don't know what Rashi is aim panavit lab notes. You want to say, but there's still someone harmed. And nonetheless, that someone harmed isn't enough. So you also need kavana. What if it's midlab note? So then, right, maybe midlab note, you don't need kavana, right? You could read it multiple layers that way if you wanted to read it that way as well. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then you quote the Magid Mishnah, right? The Magid Mishnah talks about davar shem asur lalev because he can say, look, I intended it well, right? You thought that was kavana essential as well. And I was not convinced by that at all, honestly. So what I wanted to get there was the Rambam, because the Rambam. The Rambam says that Yireta Melokecha is Davar Shelo Yuchlu Dayane Basar Badam Lishbotbo, right? There are two, whatever it says, Masrele, two possibilities. One possibility is to Davar Masrele, so the Isur is dependent on Kavana. And the other part is Davar Masrele, so accountability is dependent on knowledge of Kavana, because you'd always claim I didn't mean it and you can't be accountable. I think the Rambam is explicit that the issue of Masur Lalev, he's talking about a different context, but the only two contexts where he quotes it, right? So about whether if you look away when you see a Zakein, when you see a Zakein coming, right? That's the next line. Actually, here's something on the Mecca, right? You're just defining it, right? On Mecca, right? Where you look, we're in the shop, at the shop window. Sorry, right. He says, the reason is that judges can't hold you accountable and other people can't hold you accountable either, because you can always say, I didn't mean it.
Right. It's almost like a koach ha'taina.
Yeah, so that's very different than a claim that it's not usur. So I want to raise it. That's why I'm not convinced that the Magid Mishnah certainly.
It's like is, a putter. It's a putter b'dini adam chai b'dini shemayim kind of read. Is that okay?
Yeah. Rabbi Yonatan Kohen Yonil reads it the way you suggested, right? But he says the reason you're chayev in the case of the Mechana Shem Ra is di'af shor shlo nisbayish, but he doesn't quote Rashi's reason of lachlima. So you can put them together to create your reading, but interesting is actually as an alternative. Okay, so just putting out that I think that in terms of making the technical argument in terms of kavana that I don't think Rashi is convincing. I think the Rambam frames Masur Lalev in different terms. I think Rabbi Nosson Mekoyim Lil frames the case in different terms. So it's not obvious to me you can read that one should read it that way. And the question of whether the other case, the Rambam, is that a question of Kavanah or not? So that can leave. Okay, now the big argument, the big argument was in terms of Rav Gustman.
That's funny. I didn't think of Rav Gustman as my big argument, but.
Interesting. So I thought you built it, the claim was that if Kavanah is essential, so then it must be that Anoa B'Shogeg is in Chayev.
The funny thing with the Rav Gustman, I'll just try to explain the point I was taking from it. And you can tell me if it didn't come across clearly the way I wrote it. It was basically, I was trying to outline like three different scenarios of where Kavanah would come in. So Rav Gustman's scenario, I was just trying to say that if you are not aware that party B who's listening is going to be offended by your content, then because you are completely bishoge, you had no awareness, you don't have anything to atone for. But the case that really, what I was really getting at wasn't a case where you are not aware of how the other party will receive it. For me, the more interesting question was, what if you know that the other party will be offended by what you say, but you don't mean to cause the emotional harm? But it's like a psik reisha. You know, if you're going to say it's going to happen, is that psik reisha? Can you say you're lo mechavin when that you're not in mechavin when that happens? That was kind of, so I kind of use the contradiction more as like just a trying to outline the different possible scenarios, though I wouldn't say that was the crux of the topic I wanted to mainly address, which is when you actually know beforehand what kind of response it's going to be elicited.
Okay, so let's
if you have a diak, I'd love to hear it anyway.
Right. So one is in the Ragusman, I thought that Ragusman talked about anas mamo, not anas dvarim.
Right.
And I wasn't at all sure, right? Since the whole frame of the Gemara we quote is godol anas mamo may anas dvarim. Right. That I wasn't at all convinced that one could bring an argument from anas mamo to anas dvarim, especially since Ragusman gives a very specific reason by anas mamo, which is whether we hold the buyer responsible for knowing the value in the marketplace. So that's why I wasn't sure that, but I thought that thing might be useful in that regard. And just thinking about it was you went to Psik Resha, so the Rosh Lama Kluger there, and I thought it had a line that was much more in terms of my intuition, right? Where the whole issue in terms of the now he says, he thinks it's obvious that Gam B'Shoge Gover al Lotonu, that right, as opposed to Rav Gustman's claim, the Adam Mu'a Li'olam. Adam Ul Liolam is a very different principle than Psik Resha. Adam Ul Liolam Dafka is a principle of requiring absolute awareness. Right? So Shlomo Kluger's use of Adam Ul Liolam in the context of Lotanu, if you want to apply that to Anas Dvarim, is a very strong counter-argument in terms of whether lack of awareness is ever an issue.
I love that. I love the connection of Adam Ul Liolam and Hilchus Nezik into this. I didn't think to connect those two concepts. So.
All right, so I'm going to put that out.
It was worth coming today just for that.
Okay, excellent. So I put that out, right? Obviously, I was looking for somebody who would say it, and I found there's Shlomo Kluger.
You found it. You got the Matsati.
Let's talk about it anyway. Okay, then the last thing, so where it's built off the Ramah, right? Misha ben Mane et Atzmo Mutar Lehonehu.
Yeah.
Where the Ramah quotes this B'Shem Medrash, and he quoted the Sma, right? And the Sma, right, came with a line that was really, that where it's a question of right. Shem zelzel bechvod atzmo v'nafsho al kazelo is here a Torah v'gam acherim. Right, people who are self-humiliating. Right, if you can view them as having being responsible for their own humiliation, they're causing themselves. So then you're not chayav. Now the Sma mentions that this is right, there are two possible meanings of the Ramah. One of them is that it's retaliatory. If somebody humiliates you, you can humiliate them, humiliate them back. And the other possibility is this claim. So I just want to point out that Michilas Kod the Smara, right? The Nemuke Yosef says explicitly, right, in the actual language of Nemuke Yosef, Imone Atzmecha, which has to mean, so it has to be retaliatory. And this language, right, as opposed to Imone Atzmo, which sounds the other way, but the text in Nemuke Yosef itself, which is what the Ramah is based on, is clear. And I will add that the Smak and the Smag both have Imone Atzmecha, and to my knowledge, no Rishon has the language the way the Ramah quotes it.
Okay, you're reading the Atzmecha toward the party who's then going to shoot back.
Yeah, there's no way to, right? Atzmo can be ambiguous, right? But Atzmecha can't be.
Right. Oh, very, very good. Right, and the Ramah there actually, I mean, I'm not sure if the text that you have above, but I think when you look in the Shulchan Aruch, it actually is quoting, he is
the
Miki Yosef.
The Rekhi Yosef quotes it out. He quotes it with the text at Atzmo. But my point, right, but the text we have is Atzmecha, and right, so it's an interesting thing about whether it's plausible to read a Rishon as saying as dealing with self things, since all the texts we have of Rishonim explicitly have the meaning the other way.
Right, and are there, I mean, I'm asking this from a pure place of ignorance. I mean, are there alternative varying texts of Nemuke Yosef which would have different girsos?
I assume that the Ramah is not a typo, but what I would say, you know, I guess it's methodologically, but you don't have to argue, you don't agree with this methodologically. If I have two variants and one of them the meaning is clear and one of the meaning is ambiguous, I don't have an early source saying that the other text has a different meaning. I would generally, and this kind of other Rishonim, the Smag and the Smak, you look it up afterwards, right, have this the same text as the Nemuke Yosef. I would assume that that's probably the better text. If that's true, then the Sma and the Ramah, now, yeah, that's all a methodological question. Do you care whether the Sma is, right, is shot in the Ramah or not? But I think that's, okay, one more thing to go, then you have to go, right? Just point out that the whole argument seems to be a little bit interesting in the grounds of the Gemara Bava Kama Daf Sadi, where we talk about where a woman, right, somebody takes a woman's head covering off in the market, or Akiva's Machai and the Dal Amos. And so he's ready. He says, "Give me time," and he sets a trap. Right, and he pours oil out in front, and she takes off her handkerchief to stop the oil.
So he says, "Mishnah, right?
Was this right?
A Mishnah?
Yeah, I don't think it's a.
Oh,
is it a Mishnah? I don't remember it's a Mishnah. Anyway, the answer
I'm
is
right, that in any regard.
All right, so the answer is we don't allow people to embarrass you just because you embarrass yourself. Right, that's the response to Rabbi Akiva. Right, right to Rabbi Akiva. Right, as you said that. Right, you said, right, Rakiva says, you said that they humiliated themselves. Well, so what? Right?
Right, that line right there at the end.
Right, Lomar Teklum. So now we could have a conversation about whether we paskin a chobo batsmo, right, Avol Bishen or Roshai. But let's assume that's true, right? That most people would assume that we paskin that way. So that's the case in a dignity argument, right? That you are mezalzil ba'atzmecha. Therefore, we can be mezalzil you, doesn't get off the ground. It's against an, right? Right? It's against an open text.
Yeah.
I mean, that has to be accounted for. That has to be counted for as well. And you know, so if you throw that in to the argument that the Nemuke Yosef never said that anyway, right? So that makes the Sma's argument, all right, that's a kasha on the Sma. Okay.
Yeah, Sma. It's and I think many have, you know, kind of been challenged to understand what the Sma is saying. I mean, you know, I'm up for Tachas Raglov, but I think I've seen Gedolim and Tovim, many who've been similarly puzzled, as you pointed out, how to make sense of that Sma.
Yeah. Okay. So I wanted to point out that within the technical realm of Onas Dvarim, I have some issues with the self-imposed thing as a formal argument. I think that the Rav Moshe normal life argument is a powerful thing. I think the thing, the way I understand Rav Moshe, I think it's a really interesting conversation about what things, first of all, to what extent we talk about your emotional distress, we're talking about your social humiliation, right? If I make you think less of yourself because I act well, right? That's ridiculous, right? But you can't say like, I can't do the right thing. Every time I do the right thing, you feel inadequate, right? That's
yeah.
I will stop everyone from going to shul because I feel inadequate when they go to Minyan and I don't. It's true, right? Every time someone else goes to show, I didn't, that word, I got you adequate. But you know, that's so I think so, right, those are the questions I want to raise, right? You know, that first of all, I want to raise the question about the scope of anosmia. Second, that, right, generally, like, what sorts of emotions it relate to, under what circumstances, right, what constitutes normal life, and under what circumstances do we see you as legitimately ashamed? To what extent is that a self, a focus on how you feel about yourself or about others will feel about you? I think that the Zekin framework is an interesting thing to think about. I think those are the fun things I had learning. Well, and I want to say, right, that anyway, you know, that first of all, it was much fun reading, and it sent me, you know, doing lots and lots of learning. And that's like the, you know, you can say about a safer. Somebody read the, you know, I read the safer and I looked everything up, and everything I looked up was there.
That's good.
Right. They weren't the, you know, some of that. I posted on Facebook recently that I was reading Rabbi Dr. Leo Young's Sefer Between Man and Man, and I found all these great makaros, but none of the footnotes were right. It was maddening. But Baruch Hashem, somebody, like, everything he said actually is a makor, whether it means exactly what he says or not, but the footnotes in the book were random. So here, everything was where, you know, there, you know, even Rav Guzman was where it was where it said. That's great, and it made me look up lots of stuff and think really hard. The question is really important, and so, you know, so it certainly, you know, is meravesh shmaita, it makes us think. So that's terrific. So I'm happy to encourage everyone else to have the same experience.
Thank you, and I really appreciate learning together with you, and that's really the goal. Really, the goal is to get people to think critically about these issues. Just something like political correctness. Even we could definitely debate whether Onas Devarim is the best lens. Maybe there's other lens, Busha, different ways to think about it. But ultimately, it just comes from a very simple belief that the Torah has something to say on every issue. And I always find it distressing that, and as Katani Maskir Hayom, I started doing this when I was in Smicha. Don't look them up. They're embarrassing. But I wrote a few op-eds, like everyone does at some point, in the Times of Israel and the Forward and whatnot. And at a certain point, I was like thinking to myself, and my wife gave me some muster also. I'm like, I'm in Smicha. I'm engaging with halachic texts and rabbinic texts all day. Why don't I actually use my expertise and write about these issues? Instead of giving a baich svara, why don't I actually see what the Torah has to say? I tried my best to not insert my bias too much into it. I try to be descriptive for the most part, but ultimately the goal is that if someone has an alternative reading, like you just show me on multiple citations that you had an alternative reading and perhaps an even better reading than my own. But the point is that we are viewing these issues through the lens of the Torah and what was that? Taking responsibility.
Yeah.
For Torah. There you go. Okay. So I got the catchphrase in there as well.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Yeah, but Baruch Hashem, everyone in the world should be much better at putting the catchphrase in than I am.
Anytime. All right. Wonderful learning together.
It's my messianic era, right? Abdu Akhira Baro is wonderful. Wonderful. I hope we'll get to, you know, I hope that we'll get to do it again. I hope there'll be popular demand for us to do it again. Wishing you all Hatzlacha. On the Sefer and in the Rabbanus, and a good Moed and a Simchas Torah, and I look forward to learning again together soon.
Thank you, Vatim Lamar. Okay, take care.